Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We've all become aware of breast cancer advocacy, pink ribbons in public spaces, pink cleats on NFL football players, and community engagement efforts like fundraising walks. Well, November brings a different color to the fore, purple, for Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. Pancreatic cancer occurs much less commonly than breast cancer. There are on average 50,000 cases annually diagnosed in the United States. Breast cancer occurs 5 times as often. But cancers of the pancreas are generally more lethal. Overall, the 5-year survival for anyone diagnosed with pancreatic cancer is only around 8%, despite the major advances we've made treating cancer of other organs. The pancreas is a critical organ for both digestion and helping our body regulate blood sugar. It's where insulin is made in the body. As we'll learn today, the reason that pancreatic cancer is so difficult to treat is that symptoms don't often present until the disease is advanced, making surgical cure nearly impossible. In addition, the pancreas lays deep in the abdomen, making surgical approaches extra challenging. My guest today is Dr. Nelson Royal, a hepatobiliary surgeon who completed a fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic before moving to Tulsa. He's a new faculty member of the OUTU School of Community Medicine. He offers treatment using a technology called endoscopic ultrasound that is an advance in both cancer diagnosis and treatment. Dr. Nelson Royal of the OUTU School of Community Medicine is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Nelson Royal, welcome to Medical Monday. Tell us what pancreatic cancer is. I mean, we've sort of all heard of it, but how do you think about it?
So there are lots of different types of pancreatic cancers. The main one that we talk about and that we hear about is the ductal adenocarcinoma, and that represents the vast majority of pancreatic cancers, and that's probably one of the worst actors that exists within the pancreas. There are some other subtypes that we get. A large group will be something called a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. And occasionally people get excited about those because they can produce hormones and cause other kind of symptoms like bad ulcers and can also cause bad diarrhea. But the main actor is the ductal adenocarcinoma.
Is that what, the neuroendocrine, is that what Steve Jobs had?
Like that's that? Right. He okay. did. He did. And that had spread to his liver. And that's why he ultimately ended up with a liver transplant. But both tumors and all the pancreatic tumors can eventually spread. And we try to catch them before they've spread because once they've gotten out of the box, unfortunately, a lot of chemotherapy agents historically weren't very effective. And that's changing somewhat, but the ductal adenocarcinoma is the main actor. And unfortunately, with all pancreatic tumors, we tend to catch them very late because they tend to be asymptomatic. So people don't get symptoms until they start causing pain or they start causing them to turn jaundiced, so they turn yellow in their eyes and whatnot. So the challenge for us is catching these at an early stage, and then once we do catch them is treating them because the pancreas is a very challenging area to operate on or even take care of. Typically, most surgeons, when they graduate from their training, don't feel comfortable or have the experience to do a lot of these pancreas tumor cases. So there's a small percentage of people who actually have done enough of these where they can do them safely and even take on the challenging cases where it may require multiple large vessel resections or other kind of follow-up long-term. So the ductal adenocarcinoma that we talk about, typically we find it after it's already spread to the liver. And unfortunately, at that point, we don't have much options beyond chemotherapy agents. There's some palliative things that we can do for these patients to help them eat, drink, and move around. But predominantly, those patients are stuck with chemotherapy. Now, we're starting to catch these earlier because of better imaging tests like CAT scans and MRIs. And in those patients, we can offer them potential curative resections and therapies such as chemotherapy and radiation. So it really all goes together. Better imaging tests have helped us catch these earlier and offer some hope.
So say more about the better imaging test. I mean, is this something, I mean, people are going to listen to this program and then say, oh, geez, I'm of course worried about pancreatic cancer now. So do I need to go out and get tested for this? Is this something we don't typically screen for this, but are these being picked up incidentally on CAT scans for other reasons? Or is it when someone actually has some symptoms that we do the imaging?
The vast majority are incidental findings on imaging when we catch them early. And it's really important to know that a lot of tests that are done like CAT scans and MRIs aren't designed to look at the pancreas specifically. So just because you've had a CAT scan or an MRI that didn't see a lesion in the pancreas doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. CAT scans are designed to catch anything over a centimeter. So if you have something less than a centimeter, we have to do special types of pancreas CAT scans and pancreas MRIs to catch those lesions. And then lastly, we do an endoscopic type of procedure where we can directly visualize even smaller tumors, and that helps us localize them.
Tell us about that. Is that the endoscopic ultrasound?
That is. So endoscopic ultrasound is a new procedure that we're adding to the Tulsa region. It's something that helps us identify these tumors that are very small, and as well as getting a little sample of that tumor so that we know exactly what type of tumor we're going to treat. And at the same time, we can sometimes intervene on some of the complications that these tumors have caused, like blocking ducts and whatnot.
So walk us through that, an endoscopic ultrasound. So I'm thinking of a tube that kind of goes into your mouth and down your esophagus, into your stomach, and on into your intestine, but it has an ultrasound probe on the end, so you're actually able to generate images. And you mentioned that not only can you see, you know, through these sound images, but then you're able, because you're right there, to take tissue biopsies, which is incredibly valuable.
Yes, and that's critical for us to be able to take care of these pancreatic cancer patients and differentiate what type of tumor they have. On top of that, at the same time, we're able to deal with other issues that are going on in the pancreas. So people with pancreatic cancer oftentimes have terrible pain related to the tumor. And at the same time, we're able to numb up the nerves that go to the pancreas and at least provide some short-term relief.
And you do all that through that same ultrasound, same endoscopy?
All at the same time. And the benefit is there's no surgery required and there's no incisions required. It's simply at the same time that we're taking a look at the tumor.
Wow, that's impressive. So wait, I realized something is we should take one big step back and just remind everybody, what does the pancreas do? It's kind of this mysterious organ, but let's go really basic.
It is. So the pancreas is this little hidden organ towards your back, and right under your ribs, and it typically doesn't act up on you. But when people get things that inflame the pancreas or cause tumors in the pancreas, it causes tremendous amounts of pain, and it can cause you to be nauseous and vomit. But the pancreas's main job is to help you in digestion. And so it helps you digest your foods like fats and carbohydrates and proteins, and it produces juice. And that juice eventually goes into your intestine, and it mixes in with the bile that your liver produces to digest these foods. Without it, you're not really able to absorb your essential elements as well as your vitamins and the fat that you need to survive. On top of that, it also works to control things like blood sugars and some other factors within your body. So having a pancreas is very important and is very critical. And one of the actual early signs of pancreatic cancers is new onset diabetes. So if you're starting to show up in your 40s or 50s with diabetes, it may not just be that you ate badly your whole life. There could be actually a physical problem in the pancreas. So occasionally that will be a reason that we go out and screen for pancreatic cancers.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Nelson Royal. He's an assistant professor of surgery at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. He's a hepatobiliary surgeon, and he's here to talk with us specifically about pancreatic cancer because November is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. And let's talk a little bit about some of the numbers. I was always taught that pancreatic cancer is kind of one of those really grim diagnoses. And that's because you've already alluded to the fact that by the time it's discovered, it's usually already spread into the liver and therefore it's metastasized. And so it's very hard to treat at that point. So what are some of the numbers? I mean, how many cases are we talking about per year? And like, what is the survival in pancreatic cancer?
Well, pancreatic cancer is unfortunately one of the more rapidly increasing cancers in the United States and the world. And we don't have a great understanding for why that is. But right now, it's about the 12th most common cancer in the U.S. that we diagnose, and that represents about 53,000 cases per year. Now, within the Oklahoma region, we also have a similarly high rate of pancreatic cancer going up, and it's slightly higher in our population, we think, partially because of weight problems and diabetes, which put you at risk for it.
So obesity and diabetes are risk factors for pancreatic cancer?
Absolutely. Okay, they're some of the strongest, as well as smoking and having something called chronic pancreatitis, which is vastly underdiagnosed, unfortunately, until it's been there for about a decade. So we're missing a lot of cases, probably, of people that are at risk. Now, as far as once you have pancreatic cancer, exactly like you said, the cat can be out of the bag before we catch it. And so pancreatic cancer represents the fourth most common cause of cancer death in the United States. And it definitely has the potential to become the number one as we move forward.
And that's mainly because with the more common kinds of cancer, we've had more success in treating them. So it reflects the fact pancreatic cancer is just more lethal because of when we discovered it's often later. Am I saying that correctly?
Absolutely. And the challenge with pancreatic cancer is catching it early. Things like breast cancer, where we have mammograms that can catch them early, and then we're developing more effective treatment options, we don't necessarily have that screening method for pancreatic cancer. There are certain people that we know should get screened for pancreatic cancer, and those are people with breast mutations that cause them to get breast cancers, like BRCA mutations.
So folks with BRCA mutations should get screened for pancreatic as well.
Absolutely. That's
interesting.
The newest guideline out of the National Cancer Center recommendations, the NCCN, is that we should be screening the BRCA patients and certain other kind of familial cancer syndrome patients for pancreatic cancers.
Now, what's the 5-year survival on pancreatic cancer?
Well, it depends on what stage you present at. And certainly if you look back about 10 or 15 years ago, there were very few people that lived 5 years or even 10 years if you had pancreatic cancer, even if you got a surgery. Thankfully, we've gotten some new advances in pancreatic cancer that have allowed us to see a greater proportion of patients making it 5, 10 years, and even to a cure at that point. So I would say if you're caught early, you have a very reasonable chance, as long as you get taken care of at a reasonable time by a pancreatic cancer surgeon and a good pancreatic medical oncologist team, that you have a chance to be cured nowadays. And that's only within the past couple of years. If you present with metastases, so stage 4, you're still looking at a very dismal prognosis of only about 5 or 8% at 5 years.
So again, that emphasis on catching it early being so important and is often true with any kind of cancer. So what's involved in surgery for pancreatic cancer? So let's say someone is, I guess, really unlucky overall, but lucky enough to have pancreatic cancer in an early stage. And I know as a medical student, I learned about the Whipple procedure, which is just named after, I guess, the surgeon that coined the operation, Dr. Whipple?
Correct. Yes, that's Dr. Oldfather Whipple. And so what originally, when we were looking at pancreatic cancer back in his day, you didn't have any kind of imaging test that really guided you about what you were finding. So patients would go to surgery and just be explored, and the surgeon would find a pancreatic cancer at the time and try to figure out what to do. And Dr. Whipple actually figured out on the spot what to do for this pancreatic tumor. Nowadays, we have 2 main surgeries that we offer people with pancreatic cancers, and one is called a Whipple procedure, and that has different variants on it. Some people call a mini Whipple. Some people call some of the options like a laparoscopic or a robotic options too. And then you have a distal pancreatectomy, and we typically do that laparoscopically or robotically as well now. And so I think when you get your cancer diagnosis, the first thing is to figure out, is it something that can come out immediately? And that's one of the big advances we've made in the past 10 years is some patients who historically would not be candidates for getting surgery, which is your best chance at cure. Now we have things with chemotherapy that for a month or 2 months at a time that get patients who weren't originally surgical candidates to become surgical candidates. And so the process of getting to surgery to get that 5 or 10 year cure rate is changing drastically. Now, as far as the surgery itself, the pancreas is very tightly invested to very important blood vessels and other things around that area. So this is not a surgery to be taken lightly. As you remember in medical school, one of the mottos used to be, don't mess with the pancreas.
I do remember that, yes.
So unfortunately, this is not a surgery that a lot of people feel comfortable with. And it's really true with this surgery, as with some other surgeries, you need to do a lot of them to do it well and to offer people the best chance of cure from the operation. And so that's why a lot of national guidelines have now changed to recommend that you need to see a pancreatic specialist for this type of operation. And the reason is there are very little things that we do in the surgery that changes the outcome drastically. And what may be not a resectable surgery candidate to one person is totally different to another. So a lot of what we've been seeing here since I've gotten here is second opinions on whether or not a pancreatic cancer is resectable that another surgeon had deemed unresectable.
Wow.
And a lot of times we're able to offer people surgery or chemotherapy up front and then follow it up with a surgery.
And what are some of those small factors you mentioned? I mean, is it just about technique specifically or the tools you have or a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both. The challenge with pancreatic cancers is how they get very close to the artery and the vein that go down to your intestines. And so we have abilities to resect part of those veins or arteries that have to be reconstructed afterwards. And I would say a majority of surgeons just don't feel comfortable doing that part. And it definitely makes a big difference in survival if you can get the tumor out, even if you have to cut out that vein and artery.
Wow. So in the Whipple or the variants of the Whipple, I mean, is it you're taking out the diseased part or the tumor itself that's in the pancreas? So you're removing, you know, part of the pancreas, right?
Correct.
That's affected. And then, as you mentioned, this vessel-rich area, so you're having, I never even realized that. So you're taking out arteries or veins and then having to kind of literally replace them. Is that with bypass, like taking harvesting veins from other places, or is that just using Dacron or synthetic type of material?
We have a lot of options available to us, and I think that's one of the benefits of the transplant experience that we all have now with liver transplants. We've learned how to reconstruct these vessels, and so we have a lot of options available to us, whether it's using your own tissues, which is our preference, or using some kind of synthetic material.
Wow. But then you also, my recollection, and it's really just from patients that I've seen who've had Whipples, I mean, it typically, doesn't it involve a partial bowel resection too? Or is it just that the effects of taking out part of the pancreas are so, have so much effect on caloric intake and ability, I mean, the recovery so long? Is it, I mean, what are the issues facing someone?
Well, a Whipple procedure involves taking out the very tip of your stomach, your first portion of your small intestine, which is the duodenum, the head of the pancreas, and then the bile duct. And so when we're done taking that part out, we have to reconstruct it. And so we bring some of the intestine up, and we have three connections, one to the stomach, one to the bile ducts, and then one to the rest of the pancreas. And once you're done with that, the recovery part is very challenging historically. And I think something that we've been working on here at OU in Tulsa is improving that process and making it as less as possible. Back when you and I were in training, people who had a Whipple surgery would stay in the hospital for weeks.
Yeah, they sure
and,
did.
And after they got done, their nutrition was a major issue because they just didn't feel hungry and they were having trouble getting up and moving around. Some of the new techniques that we have available to us here that we're bringing to Tulsa community is early recovery protocols. And that allows you to have a hospital stay on as short as 4 or 5 days. And then it also helps you recover faster so that you're up and about moving and your diet somewhat improves.
Wow. So that's really is impressive. I mean, way shorter than I remember on anyone with a Whipple.
Absolutely.
So I want to ask you about Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, because one of the things I learned in preparing for this, and you're wearing a purple ribbon here today. So I was not aware. Of course, we're all very aware just due to the overwhelming. Well, and of course, it is a more common diagnosis, breast cancer, but there has been an amazing publicity awareness campaign. And so people know about pink and the National Football League, and I think Major League Baseball, they have these pink days. But so the color, I guess, for pancreatic cancer is purple. And there are various events and things around Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. What can you share with us about that?
November is our opportunity to raise awareness about pancreatic cancer to the United States. And it is, unfortunately, one of the lesser known cancers. I think most of us have known of someone who either had and survived or more likely had and died from pancreatic cancer. So our color for our month is purple. And I think that reflects how central the pancreas is to your function overall. And it's a very royal color. And I appreciate that. But we have a lot of support groups nationally for pancreatic cancer, both the patients and their family members. And I think it's very valuable to be engaged if you have had a loved one that was involved in it or you are yourself going through the process of dealing with pancreatic cancer. There are things like survivorship groups that we offer locally to allow you to meet other people who are going through what you're going through. And then we also have different types of awareness groups. And one of the local chapters that we have here is Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. And it's a national organization that's designed to raise awareness as well as to raise research initiatives for pancreatic cancer. And so one of the activities that we have is something called Purple Stride, and that's kind of the main awareness event that we have, and that's in the spring. And we'll have more about that on our website at PanCan Oklahoma chapter. The main website is pancan.org, and I would encourage anyone who's either a survivor or a family member to check out the website and find a way to get involved.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Nelson Royal. He is a hepatobiliary surgeon, new to Tulsa and new to the OUTU School of Community Medicine. He is a surgeon who specializes in, well, hepatobiliary, so liver and pancreatic surgeries. And then it turns out, too, you're somewhat of an expert. We alluded to it earlier with the endoscopic ultrasound, but you have sort of an academic interest in ultrasound technology. I guess let's start by remind us what ultrasound is. I mean, everyone I think knows about it most commonly from obstetric ultrasound and like looking at babies while they're still in their mom's womb. But ultrasound has many uses in medical practice. So how do you use an ultrasound?
Well, I think that's one of the more emerging modalities that we have available to us. You know, we have things like CAT scan and MRI and even things like PET scans, but ultrasound we think of when we're pregnant and we want to see the baby. But the applications to us in medicine are kind of ubiquitous. We can look at the heart, we can look at the eye, we can look in the lungs, we can look in the belly even. And so historically, ultrasound was done by a radiologist in a lab, and you would go in and you'd get an ultrasound of your gallbladder, and he would tell you you have gallstones or you don't. And a very broad picture was looked at. More recently, I would say within the past 10, 15 years, especially our emergency medicine colleagues have started to try to take ultrasound out of the radiology lab and apply it at bedside. So it's a part of our physical exam now. You have your stethoscope, you listen to the lungs, and then you take the ultrasound and you look at the lungs and you look at the heart and you get more information, much more detailed information, and it allows you to rapidly make a change in how you're going to manage that patient and take care of that person. It avoids potentially a lot of unnecessary tests. If I can pull out an ultrasound from my pocket and take a look at someone's heart and tell that they have mitral valve prolapse, I don't need to go and order a CT scan to figure out why they're having symptoms of heart failure. I already know the answer. And so the idea is that you want to speed up and provide better care more cost efficiently too. And so I think that's what we're trying to do with ultrasound is teach medical students, teach residents, how can you use this excellent tool that's now miniaturized? It's no longer the size of a computer that in a room within radiology. It's now something you can take out of your pocket, just like your iPhone.
I mean, there are devices. I've seen adapters connected to iPhones, but is that what you use, or do you use something more handheld that's more specifically like a black box ultrasound type of thing?
I'll use both. And we have some that look more like a laptop, and that's the one I most commonly use. And we have those floating throughout the hospital and in the clinics. But we also have adapters, like you mentioned, that can connect to the phone. And that's, I think, the best is that we work towards getting this ultrasound tool just to be like a stethoscope. You want to examine the patient. You put your hands on, you evaluate, do you feel any masses? Do you feel the liver? Then you listen to the belly, you listen for bowel sounds, and then you take the ultrasound out and you actually see the liver. You see the bowels. You can see the pancreas. And you can answer the questions that otherwise you'd be ordering CAT scans or MRIs that cost thousands of dollars.
And these are done, as you point out, right at the bedside or in the exam room. So you're just doing it on the spot. It's part of your exam. So how does it, you mentioned that the pancreas is very deep. Are you able with a bedside ultrasound or a handheld device to see what you need to see in terms of like gas patterns or things to look at a pancreas? Or is that still like it require radiology?
So if you're looking at the pancreas particularly, usually you can get a good window and actually identify the pancreas with an ultrasound at bedside, just like the radiologist would. It's more of a teaching someone how to use the ultrasound itself. For more specific questions, we're stuck with doing the endoscopy and putting the ultrasound probe on the end of the endoscope to get a better look at the pancreas. But for very focused questions that we have, such as does this person have pancreatitis, do they have gallstones, do they have a liver mass, I can identify that right there at the bedside.
That is really neat. I want to go back to the endoscopic ultrasound for a minute because I think it is really a breakthrough in technology. And you mentioned sort of the issue where ultrasound used to be the sole providence of radiologists and how now general physicians or ER physicians or surgeons in your case are using ultrasound right at the bedside. But in a similar way, the endoscopic ultrasound has kind of allowed you as a surgeon who focuses mostly on the abdomen and abdominal organs and viscera, you're able to even look at the chest. And what's remarkable about this technology is you can sometimes even biopsy like a lung tumor or something that hides out in the chest, which is sort of heretofore had been kind of off limits to a surgeon. I mean, not of course to a chest surgeon, but to an abdominal surgeon. I mean, can you at least in training did some of those things, right? Biopsies of lung tumors or esophageal things?
Absolutely. It all goes together and how you need to get samples of tissue, such as things like lymph nodes or even the main tumor itself, things within the esophagus runs through the chest. And so the whole way that we work up and decide is someone a candidate for having their esophageal cancer treated with surgery is by doing this endoscopic ultrasound. So almost every single esophageal cancer patient needs an endoscopic ultrasound to be able to stage them appropriately. Are you stage 1, 2, 3, or 4? Similarly with lung cancers, historically we had to do a surgery where we actually made an incision in your collar level and go down and take out lymph nodes from around your heart to tell if the cancer was resectable or not. Nowadays, we're able to go down with a little tiny scope at the end of a bronchoscopy, find those lymph nodes and take little tiny samples of it endoscopically. So it's really been a drastic change in what you have to go through as a patient.
I mean, that winds up being an outpatient procedure, right? Just go to the, you know, the lab or the clinic or we're at the I guess the suite as it would be called, and you'd go home after you kind of wake up, as opposed to being in the hospital and having what amounts to a major operation with having your clavicle, you said?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It used to be a somewhat of a big recovery and a reasonable amount of complications associated with the surgery. And the less we have to do big surgeries to stage patients who still haven't even gotten their treatment for the cancer, the better we're going to do.
So I'm curious about you. You're new to Tulsa. Did you always know you wanted to be a surgeon, or was it something you sort of decided once you were in medical school or thereabouts?
Oh, my goal was never to be a surgeon. When I first got in, I wanted to do anything but surgery. And unfortunately, it's like the bug. It just hooks you. And the opportunity, I think, what I wasn't sold on surgery until I was doing my surgical oncology rotation as a third-year student. And I saw that you got to actually get to know the patients and that you got to know their family, and you never really lost contact with those patients. To me, I think that's the best part of medicine, is getting to know patients, getting to learn more about the diseases that we're trying to treat and know the person so that you can really personalize the care that we need to provide. So that's why I kind of gravitated towards pancreas and liver cancer, because you really do get to establish a real bond with the patient. And everything that we do is completely focused around that individual. What may be right for one person is totally wrong for the next person. And it's getting to know that person and getting to know their family and their circumstances to make those decisions with them.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about is you were telling me that earlier you had been doing some work in Florida, and this was unfortunate, but the night of you were graduating from, was it fellowship or residency? And that was the night of the Pulse nightclub shooting, where I think 49 people were killed. I mean, what an awful thing. But you actually got called on to duty, even though you were sort of almost done with your fellowship. You had to go in and...
Yeah, so I did my residency at Orlando Regional Medical Center, which was a site where the Pulse nightclub shooting was, actually just down the block. And I lived across the street from that area. And it was the night after I graduated, I got a phone call about 2 a.m. And it was a frantic call to come in and help. And I thought at first it was a prank to tease me since I just graduated. But it was actually, you know, as we found out later, this horrific shooting. And so we spent the next several hours operating and trying to take care of all these patients. And I have to say, it was one of the more harrowing events that I've been through. Very impressed with everyone that helped take care of the patients. And the best part about what we did that day was the statistic I heard was that of everyone that got shot and made it to the hospital, no one died in the hospital. Wow. And so I think thanks to the efforts of all the bystanders who moved people from the club to the hospital, as well as everyone in helping to get these patients to the OR so that we could do the surgery that we needed to do and get them recovered, was just a massive effort. We had everyone come in, all residents, all faculty from the ICU down to the internists, and even the CEO of the hospital came in and was there trying to help coordinate activities so that we could take the best care of these patients.
Wow, I don't remember ever hearing that side of the story. I'm sure it came out around that time, but really an all hands on deck situation. And as you say, like pretty heroic, I mean, in spite of a horrible tragedy.
Yeah, and I think it's only possible because everyone recognized at the time just to come in and take care of everything and do whatever we could to take care of these patients. And unfortunately, Orlando was somewhat of a busy trauma center, and so we were used to dealing with a lot of traumas, obviously never this much at once, but a very altruistic group of people who helped us take care of these patients, because without the nurses and the scrub techs and the medical assistants and obviously the administration, we wouldn't have been able to accomplish what we did that day.
Well, Dr. Nelson Royal, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You are brand new at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. You're a hepatobiliary surgeon and also informing us really about Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. And thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.